Awesome. Okay, well, firstly, thank you very much for the invitation to talk to you today. What I want to tell you about is some recent work I've been doing regarding the constraints you can set on decaying dark matter using the Fermi telescope data and the implications of those constraints for the recent measurements of astrophysical neutrinos by IceCube. So this work is was presented in this reference here, and it was done with Tim Cohen, Kota Marase, Ben Safdie, and Yotam Sarek. Okay, so the aim of my talk today is to present to you this plot. You do not need to absorb all of this immediately. Basically, I'm going to use the full time of my talk to walk you through all of the ingredients that go into this, but this is the thing I want you to take away from it. So as I said before, what I'm going to be telling you about is constraints on dark matter decay. And so the plot that we're always going to be thinking about for this thing is the limit space on dark matter decay. So on the x-axis, we're going to be talking about the mass of the dark matter. And here you can see we're talking from about 100 GeV up to extremely high masses. In particular, we'll be covering the PeV range, which is where IceCube is seeing definitively astrophysical neutrinos. And on the y-axis, we'll have the lifetime of the dark matter. So in a bit more detail, in the first part of my talk, I'm going to explain to you these blobs here. And what these blobs represent is, if you interpret what IceCube has seen as coming from dark matter — I'll give you more of an overview for why anybody would even say that sentence — then this is the range where you'd want the dark matter to live. So understandably, it's sitting at about a PeV, and I don't have the best intuitive explanation for why the lifetime has to be there, but just to give you some perspective, this is about 10 orders of magnitude longer than the age of the universe. Okay, then in the second part of my talk, I want to explain to you how we've set limits on this space using data from the Fermi Gamma Ray Telescope. And so our limits are the black ones here. So if you're used to looking at, say, dark matter direct detection plots or indirect detection limits, you might think that this is the worst one on the plot because it's at the top. But for decay, it's the exact opposite, so we're happy that we're up the top. And the idea here is that if you have a longer lifetime, the decays will happen more rarely, so you get smaller amounts of flux, so it's harder to constrain. So higher up the plot is better. And something that is interesting about our limits, just to point out of the box, is that one, we're cutting right into this parameter space, where if you want to interpret IceCube as dark matter. And a second thing that is interesting is that Fermi can't see photons above, say, about 2 TeV. And yet see here that our limits are extending well above 2 TeV. And so how exactly we're able to do this with that instrument is something I'll explain later on in my talk. There's a lot of other lines on this plot, and I need to say a few words about each of those. And so what these other lines are coming from is they were constraints that existed in the literature before we did our work. As you can see, none of them cut into the IceCube parameter space, but there's still a lot of interesting physics in those. So I'll go through and give a bit of an overview of what else existed in the field before we added our black line onto this plot. And then for the majority of my talk, as I'll explain in a couple of slides, I'll be talking about a very simplified, like just a final state idea of dark matter decay, where you have dark matter decaying straight to BB bar. I'll explain why I'm talking about that, but towards the end, I'll say a few words about going beyond this to other final states and also about more realistic models. Okay, so just to set the scene before I give you a bit of a review of the story of IceCube, I just want to say something about heavy dark matter, because you might not be used to thinking about this. So of course, we have our theoretical prejudices that tell us that potentially dark matter might be living around, say, the electroweak scale, or maybe it's even well motivated to be an axion at much lighter masses. But fundamentally, we don't have any principle that forbids particle dark matter from being anywhere from about 10 to the minus 22 EV or even up to 10 to the 25 EV. And then even if you don't constrain yourself to particle dark matter, if you say you want something like primordial black holes, then the mass can cover an even higher range. But something that's interesting about these high masses is that it may only be observable at indirect detection in experiments like Fermilat and IceCube. So I wasn't aware of this until yesterday, but Joe pointed out to me that actually, so the statement that it couldn't be detected in direct detection isn't exactly true, but the argument as to why it gets harder to detect very heavy dark matter in direct detection is we know how much dark matter mass there is out there. That's what we can actually measure using our gravitational probes. So if we increase the mass of each individual dark matter particle, we have to decrease the number density. And because the direct detection scattering rate is related to the number density, the rate for that will go down. And then the reason why we couldn't see these heavy masses at colliders is just simply if it's above the center of mass energy of the collider, you can't produce it. So that's why it's very interesting to see, like, IceCube is only now starting to probe this very high energy space where dark matter might live. And if this is the dark matter of our universe, this experiment might be the first one to see any hint of the particle nature of dark matter. So you want to take the data it sees quite seriously. So with that in mind, let me tell you about what IceCube has seen, and also the main part of this, the main aim of this part of my talk will be to put these lines and these blobs onto the overall plot. Okay, so let's be optimistic for a second and say that maybe what IceCube has seen really is dark matter. So if that's the case, then what we would have as the dark matter of our universe is potentially something very heavy that is then decaying to neutrinos. How would we see these neutrinos as a detector? Well, there will be two contributions. Firstly, we know we're living in a dark matter halo, the Milky Way. So prompt decays within that Milky Way halo will look like something like this on the sky, and that will give us a flux. Also, we know that there's dark matter all throughout the universe, and so those decays will also contribute, once you account for the redshifting, together to the total flux we would see. And generally, this follows a decay-type flux, which is much less anisotropic than, say, for dark matter annihilation. Okay, and so then what has IceCube actually seen? So there's a number of ways to interpret what they've done. What I'm showing you in this plot here is a combined maximum likelihood analysis from six different IceCube analyses that was done in this reference here. And this is essentially the data. So you might be familiar with BERT, ERNIE, and Big BERT, which are these extremely high-energy neutrinos around a PEV that have been detected. But actually, at this stage, IceCube claims that they've seen around, say, 800 astrophysical neutrinos. But in order to make such a statement, because their biggest background, or one of their largest backgrounds, is atmospheric neutrinos, which have quite a different spectral index than what you would expect for astrophysical neutrinos. And so you need to accurately subtract the much larger atmospheric background at lower energies in order to accurately determine how many astrophysical you have. So there's some uncertainty in exactly how many astrophysical they've seen, but it's of order 800. And this is their best guess as to what the spectrum would look like. So if you think this is coming from some standard form of astrophysics, you would generically expect the spectrum to be a power law of with a spectral index of about -2 to -2.2. This is not what's been observed. They actually see it's about -2.5. And this is at some level driving some of the tension that people are saying, maybe it's not astrophysics, maybe it's dark matter. I would counter that with saying this is the first attempt they've made at putting the spectrum together. IceCube's still in its very early days. And I think that subtracting that atmospheric background is a very challenging thing, and they'll be able to do it better as the instrument runs longer. So I don't think this is unlikely, I think, to be the number that they finally settle on. But if you take it at face value, it does appear to have some issues with the an astrophysical explanation.
Just to ask, how do they get error only
0.09? Oh, so that is when you just, like, you can download this data here, and when you just fit a power law to it and with the error bars on it, that's what the one sigma error is on those.
Looks like much worse errors on.
So true, but the errors are also correlated, right? So you can't just off the top of your head. Yeah. I assume they know how to do statistics, so yeah. Okay, so what I'm saying here is, okay, let's be ridiculously optimistic and say maybe everything here is coming from dark matter. Now, I think you can already see that what dark matter would give you isn't necessarily a better fit to a power law, but let's just follow this logic for a second. So if that was the case, then this spatial flux I told you about before would come into your detector and give you a spectrum like this. And then we can fit that spectrum to see where you get the best fit and where you get regions of a good fit for a BB bar spectrum. And this is this green blob, the first thing I wanted to put on this plot here. And as expected, it sits for a dark matter mass of around a PEV. So just want a quick aside about why I'm going to be talking about BB bar for the majority of my talk. So as you saw, IceCube has seen astrophysical neutrinos over a reasonably large range of energies. And if you look at the prompt neutrino spectra for various different final states, you can see for example, for nu nu bar here in blue, it's almost a delta function. But for BB bar, it's actually quite broad. So you generally get the best fit to all of the data if you do BB bar. Now, I don't personally think that everything IceCube is seeing is coming from dark matter, but it just gives us sort of a straw man that we can then attack when we're thinking about setting our Fermi constraints.
You could also have like three particle final states or something.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, but I mean,
if you have two invisibles and one neutrino state, then you could not constrain it at all from us.
As long as you have a neutrino, I think you'll be able to constrain it from gamma, as I'll explain to you later.
Okay.
Generically, when people do this, before you've seen anything, people just set limits or look for things in terms of specific final states, because there's a lot of dark matter models out there, and it's a lot easier to do that than to think about any particular model. But I'll say some more about models later on.
So that previous plot, that your contour was for a specific...
This is for BB bar. This is like everything I'm going to be showing on this plot is for BB bar. I will show other final states at the end of my talk.
But it's presuming a particular dark matter mass.
The dark matter mass is varying. So the best fit point is for that dark matter mass, so what is it, about 10 PV and that lifetime. And then this region around here gives a up to some confidence level a goodness of fit region. Yeah. Okay. So IceCube does a number of different analyses. The data set I showed you earlier on comes from their so-called HESI data set, or high energy starting events. As you go to lower energies, the backgrounds become more complicated, so they need to do a more complicated data analysis, but they do perform such a thing. And then they have these messy analyses. And also, although it's a more complicated analysis, they see an excess in the messy data, which is this, the blue is a dark matter fit. So if you ignore the blue, you can see that there's an excess over the expected backgrounds. And these authors here, late last year, put out an analysis saying that yes, as dark matter often can do, it can explain a, an excess in astrophysical data sets. And so when you put in this blue region, you get this second blob here. So the way to think about these two blobs, there's a potential excess in the IceCube data set, and if you want to explain it with dark matter, this is the region you want to be thinking about.
So I didn't get what's the difference. One is the...
One is looks at lower energies.
Oh.
So you can get astrophysical neutrinos to lower energies, but then the atmospheric background, because that's growing more sharply, is much harder to subtract. So it's a more complicated analysis. Okay, so now I'm going to say a few words about why, beyond just this particularly soft spectral index I mentioned earlier, why there is some tension with the standard astrophysical explanation of where these neutrinos are coming from. But just at the start, I'll say that this is very much an open problem as to where these are coming from, and a lot of people are thinking about it. So before IceCube was turned on, one of the things that people thought would potentially dominate the contribution to the neutrino flux would be active galactic nuclei, such as blazars. So for example, in the Fermi era, Fermi has discovered more than 3,000 point sources. The majority of these are known to be blazars. So it was thought that these blazars might also be producing neutrinos. So I'm no expert on these, but roughly what you can have with a blazar is if you have a supermassive black hole at the center of a galaxy and there's accretion onto it, then you can get a large jet forming out in either direction. And if this jet is then pointed along our line of sight, we can get particularly strong gamma ray emission. We know that, and people thought maybe you could also get potentially strong neutrino emission down there. So the thing about these, though, as I said, you need quite a specific number of setups for something to occur, especially this line of sight requirement. And so these are not expected to be that common on the sky, so if they appear, they should appear as point sources. So what you could do to test the hypothesis that the IceCube data is coming from AGNs would be to see if the neutrinos that are coming in, as I said now, you've got order 800, so you can actually do such a statistical test, see if they're coming from point sources. IceCube has done such an analysis, and they do not see any evidence for any point sources at all. And so, and this is, as I said, they now have a lot of neutrinos. This isn't due to a lack of sensitivity. If all of the IceCube flux was coming from AGNs, we would have seen a point source. So this first simplest idea that people thought what might be giving the neutrino flux is already ruled out. That doesn't mean AGN can't contribute at all. It just means that they're not giving an order one, essentially, contribution to the IceCube flux. So, yeah.
So, I mean, does this just mean that you've ruled out AGN's pointing towards Earth as contributing?
Yeah, so like essentially blazars. Then there's, depending on what their angle of inclination is to us, there's a whole spectrum of names they can be given. And no, the other ones can't be ruled out because they won't appear as point sources. So this is just ruling out the idea that what IceCube is seeing is coming from point sources, which would have been interpreted as blazars. So actually, I'm going to use this.
Saying they're not coming from point sources, it's kind of saying that there is an upper bound on the density of sources, right? Which kind of currently
then? No, I don't know this off the top of my head, but I can point you to this reference here where they did this. And there might even have been a more recent paper that came out very recently.
So if you say, I think you use the beaming angle of blazars and say what you think roughly their densities around us to say how many there are, but I don't think the higher energy spectrum of these guys is known in general. So I think you have one additional variable. So you can say maybe there's a really high energy flux of particles coming out of the AGNs in general, or something like that.
So I'm going to take this as a very tenuous opportunity to have an aside. And so what I've currently been working independent of this dark matter decay work is using a recent statistical method called the MPTF to try and push these IceCube point source searches even further. And the idea of the MPTF is it looks for sub-threshold point sources statistically. So I'm just going to use this as a 5-minute aside on this other topic. So what the MPTF is a rigorous statistical method to look for sources and even unresolved point sources. And what MPTF it is a rapid implementation of the statistics. So recently with Ben Safi, who was also an author on this decay work and a grad student at Princeton, Siddharth, we put this code into a public incantation which you can download and play around with yourself. And so I'll just say basically what this is doing, if you have followed at all the story of the Fermi gamma ray axis, initially people thought an anomaly on the sky, probably dark matter, and then as people looked at it more closely, it looks like it's now probably coming from point sources. And the reason that people are believing it's mainly from point sources is because of largely this MPTF. So let me tell you roughly what that's doing. So in the context of the galactic center axis, the idea here was we looked in Fermi at the center of the galaxy. You expect that to be where the dark matter is peaked, and you saw an excess there. So people got very excited. So then the question the MPTF tries to address, is this what it looks like a smooth distribution that's falling off, like the NFW of dark matter, or squared in the annihilation case? Or is it actually a collection of point sources around the galactic center? So if this was the question you had to ask, you could just give it to a grad student. It wouldn't be too hard to just see by eye. But then what you actually have is this very bright diffuse emission on top of that. So you need to give it to a grad student to give it to a computer to figure this out. And so what we want to exploit here is the fact that, just to emphasize why this was quite a hard problem originally, dark matter to BB bar at, say, 40 GeV gives you a spectrum that looks like this, perfectly fits the data here. Pulsars, which would also appear as point sources, give you almost an identical spectrum. So the energy information tells you nothing. You need to find some way to leverage this spatial information. So what is the spatial information? It's basically saying that as you move away from the center here, the point-to-point variation isn't that large. Whereas in the point source case, you have a number of very bright points where you have a point source and a number of very dim points where you don't have one. So the point-to-point variation is much larger. And just to show you, you can actually turn this into a different statistical distributions. I'll just give you some insight to this, but from basically what I've told you here, you could build up the statistical distribution yourself. So let me say, consider the two different scenarios, one where you have dark matter smoothly falling off and one where you have point sources dotted around the place. In these two different distributions, I'm going to set up one where you, in both cases you expect 10 photons per pixel, and then I'm going to ask the question, what's the probability of getting 0, 12, or 100 photons? Okay, so in this case, you know that this mean is just the Poisson distribution. So if you have a Poisson with mean 10, you know how to calculate 12. It turns out to be about 10%. What's the probability of 0? Much more unlikely. You have to Poisson fluctuate a lot further, so that's about 10 to the minus 4. Probability of seeing 100 photons in a pixel, yeah, you're going to need a lot of pixels. That's not going to happen very often. Okay, so let me think about the equivalent situation for a point source population. This time, you expect 1 in 10 pixels to have a point source, and you expect each point source to give you 100 photons. So again, you would expect a mean 10 photons per pixel, but the statistics are very different. So what's the probability of getting 12 photons? Well, you need to have at least one point source to get any photons. But then you need that point source to Poisson fluctuate from 100 down to 12, so that's very unlikely. What about the probability of 0? That's quite likely, because most of the pixels have no point source. And the probability of 100? Well, then you just need one point source to Poisson fluctuate to its mean, so that's not that unlikely either. So you can see that even though these two distributions have the same mean, the statistics are very different. And obviously this is a toy example because they're extremely different, but you can build this up into a rigorous statistic and leverage the two and let the data tell you which one's preferred. Okay, so then that's how the statistics built up. What do we actually do in the code? Well, if you just write that down in the way I said, it's not very fast. So we had to come up with a number of math tricks and also write a lot of C code to make this work out of the box quickly. But we've now set this up in a manner where you don't have to worry about any of these things. You can just download it and run it on a data set. And so as I said, this has been shown to work in the Fermi context. It can recreate known point sources and also seems to suggest strongly the evidence of sub-threshold sources and a lot of them around the galactic center. And as I mentioned previously, this is something I'm also currently applying to IceCube. We're in talks with Chandra and Newstar to use this method. But if you can think of an astrophysical data set where point sources might be a problem, we're always looking for new opportunities.
Those pictures were not Fermi, right?
Which pictures?
One back, two back. Those.
I mean, this is Monte Carlo. Yeah, so I mean, because we can't, this would be the dream scenario if you could just resolve it like this. This is Monte Carlo of what the galactic center axis would look like if it was dark matter or if it was point sources
because
in Fermi.
With Fermi, you basically have no angular resolution, right? Or way worse than, say, Chandra. With Chandra, you
yeah, oh no, definitely
you
true.
You actually see this probably as Chandra.
Yes, but as you could see earlier, the spectrum's dropping off, right? So Chandra's not the way to... to necessarily look at these things. And it's actually not so obvious. The galactic center is a very difficult region for some other instruments as well. Like in the field of view around the galactic center, where Fermi might see one point source, Chandra might see 10,000 or something like that, because they have so much more angular view. And actually sorting out which one of these could be emitting in gamma rays and which ones aren't isn't so obvious as just from the X-ray data alone. So, yeah. Okay, so that ends that shameless plug. And what I'm going to come back to now is just to remind you, I was talking about the tension that exists between potential astrophysical explanations of the Ice Cube data and why, once the data was seen, people started to think that these could have problems. So I previously showed you, and this was the aside for point sources, that pure blazar explanations of Ice Cube appear to be ruled out. Before the instrument was turned on, something else people thought might be giving a dominant amount of the flux was starburst galaxies. So starburst galaxies are galaxies that are undergoing an intense period of star formation. You don't need any particular geometry to get these, so these wouldn't be ruled out by a point source search. There should be tons of them out there. But the interesting thing about starburst galaxies is we know the exact same process that would give us neutrinos, pion decay, would also give us photons. So once we know the spectrum of... If we say that what we're seeing in Ice Cube is coming from starburst galaxies, we could predict what number of photons we would have at lower energies. And so some people have made the argument that if you try and explain all of what is seen in Ice Cube as coming from starburst galaxies, there's some tension with the Fermi data. And so that would, in particular, this reference here. But I think that a number of people don't think that it's totally certain yet. The basic driving force of this tension is the fact that starburst galaxies doesn't want the Ice Cube data to have this soft spectral index of 2.5. So if that varies around a bit, I think that these starburst galaxies could remain a very good candidate for what Ice Cube is seeing. Okay, so for the reasons I said, some people are making the argument that the two main sources of neutrinos people thought would contribute to the Ice Cube flux before it turned on might be in tension with the data. And so because of that, people are writing papers saying maybe it's coming from dark matter. But I just think there's an overall thing to keep in mind about this story regarding why I think that probably what we're seeing in Ice Cube is at least the majority coming from astrophysics. And this is this so-called coming from this so-called Waxman-Bacall bound. So back in 1998, these two authors made the following argument, or at least this is a simplified version of it. So we've measured extremely high energy cosmic rays at experiments like Pierre Auger up at, say, this famous baseball pitch proton at like 10 to the 20 EV. And we know that roughly the spectrum of cosmic rays up there. And as I said before, generally we know the processes that give us our neutrinos and cosmic rays can be... are correlated with each other because, for example, through processes like pion decay. Although there's a lot of uncertainties, what these authors did is they said, well, if we take all of these uncertainties to have their upper limit, how many neutrinos would you expect at roughly the Ice Cube range? And this is the blue line you get here. And you can see that the data they're finding is pretty close to this. Dark matter could have been anywhere. So it does potentially raise the argument that what we're seeing is largely from astrophysics. This point, however, you can see is quite a bit above their so-called upper bound. So the basic gist is, if this point really is true, then this would be a very interesting thing to look into more closely. But this point is in this regime where you really need an accurate subtraction of your atmospheric background. So if there's any errors there, then I think this could change around a lot. So
just what's the energy dependence of the blue line?
Oh, everything I'm plotting here is E squared times dNdE, or E squared times d phi dE. So this is just E to the minus 2.
It should be flat.
Yeah, it should be flat in this E when you multiply it by E squared. Yeah.
So when the errors on the black crosses, that's not folded into it, the uncertainty in doing the atmospheric subtraction, or is that?
I mean, they've attempted their best to put this in, right? So obviously there'll be statistical and systematic errors in here, and the claim would be that potentially there's a systematic they haven't properly understood yet, which I think is, I would also emphasize, in the first few papers Ice Cube has published, their main goal was discovering astrophysical neutrinos at these energies, which they have now succeeded in doing. Their follow-up will be to understand these neutrinos in as much detail as possible, and part of that will be the spectrum. So the focus of the papers where the spectrum was extracted from was not measuring a spectrum. So I think that you should take this with a pinch of salt so far, but if once the data is better understood, this settles down to be the real spectrum, then this point will be something that will need to be understood carefully, because it does appear anomalous when taken into in light of the Waxman-Bacall bound.
So just to say, blue is sort of max, or the minimum astrophysical flux.
Maximum, you would
maximum.
Expect. So this,
no,
the fact is above this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the red is the atmospheric contribution?
No, the red is a fit, power law fit, and like a spread on that power law fit. Yeah.
But isn't that the line, the atmospheric contribution included, or is it not?
No, this is meant to be just astrophysical.
That's
all the
astrophysical,
all atmospheric subtracted.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, blue is it minimum or maximum? I thought it's kind of minimum.
It was
no,
the maximum that.
The rays which are coming, it's going to gravitate to produce some ingredients.
So there could be different ways you could take the logic that they used here, but what they did in their paper was my understanding is they took the most optimistic values of all uncertainties to try and get an upper limit on what flux you should see. And this, the Waxman-Bacall-Baum, for example, was used as sort of a benchmark for detectors like IceCube when they were constructing it. This was sort of the minimum thing you had to aim for because this was the most they expected to see in the.
You just mentioned why there can be some sources which are kind of very opaque for protons and the good sources of neutrinos. How can
the maximum coming from the source that's producing the cosmic rays that we see?
Right. Yeah. So there could be some source that's giving you neutrinos that's not giving you these cosmic rays potentially.
Right.
This isn't an unbeatable bound, right? I'm sure that with astrophysics maybe you could also explain how you could get above this, but the simple out of the box thing would be it's a bit difficult to explain with astrophysics, unless you have some sort of source that doesn't give you these high-energy cosmic rays either. Okay, so with that in mind, one other line I just want to add into this is, let's say in a couple of years it turns out that we do understand that what IceCube is seeing is pretty much dominantly astrophysics. What limit could you then use IceCube to set on dark matter? And that would be this red line here. But it's a dotted line to indicate the fact that this isn't a real limit yet until we actually understand where these neutrinos are coming from. Okay, so that wraps up the first part of my talk. And so what you should take away from this for the rest of the talk is just that this is an interesting range to think about if you want to set limits on decaying dark matter, and particularly those models that are trying to explain the IceCube data as coming from dark matter. So that's sort of what the range we want to target with our Fermi measurements. So in the second part of my talk, I'm going to go through how we derive this black line. So the basic reason why you want to think about gamma ray data is that if you have dark matter giving you neutrinos, then even in the most pessimistic scenario where you have something such as dark matter going straight to nu bar, you will still get photons due to electroweak corrections. Electroweak potential is pretty well known, but if you're not used to thinking about it, it's the electroweak analog of, say, a photon Bremsstrahlung or gluon radiation off a quark, for example. And just in the same way, we know neutrinos are charged onto something in the standard model, SU2, so they can also radiate Ws and Zs. What I don't mean here is that as you produce a neutrino, as it free streams to Earth, it's just radiating Ws and Zs. You should think about this as a higher order correction to the initial hard decay. So for example, like FSR, if you were calculating something at a collider. So even though if we believe in SU2 as a gauge theory, this is a real effect and it should be there, as far as I'm aware, the first direct measurement of this effect was actually recently performed by ATLAS in this reference here. And what they did there, we know something else that's charged under SU2, quarks. And so actually at high enough energies, quarks should emit Ws and Zs just as they also emit gluons, and this measurement's been made and confirmed.
So is there some way around this? If the dark matter decays to sterile neutrinos and then they oscillate?
Potentially, but at some level, if you have neutrinos there, then you could have some higher order correction that involves.
If something have a stage decay, like in the case of something, they boosted something, then that something decays neutrinos, but at a much lower mass, so you don't get the electroweak corrections.
Yeah, you can.
Well, you just decay to sterile neutrinos, so there's no brand there.
But if it's a much lower mass, how are you going to get PEV neutrinos?
Because they boosted.
They're boosted.
You produce a very high energy, low mass thing.
Okay.
Does it scatter or anything?
It's a slow decay. It has met a lot of times decay.
Yeah, but I mean, it has to be. I mean, it's propagating while it's decaying, so it can scatter.
You can very easily make it.
Cook something up.
It won't scatter, but it will.
Okay, yeah, so I haven't thought about that in particular, but in your generic out-of-the-box thing where you're explaining prompt decays.
Yeah, it's
a prompt.
It's a
two-bit dot pattern.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. But yeah, in the generic sense, you will get photons. And as a non-experimentalist, the good thing about this is Fermi is an amazing measurement of these sorts of gamma ray photons, and you don't need to convince them to do an analysis. You can just download the data and do it yourself, which is what we did. So let me tell you, I explained briefly earlier on what you would expect to see from neutrinos. Let me tell you what you would expect to see from photons. And here there are three main contributions, whereas there was essentially only two in the neutrino case. So firstly, you have a prompt galactic spectrum. So and there, when the dark matter decays, it can give you these prompt photons, and they will essentially just free stream straight to us. You can also get an inverse Compton galactic spectrum, which will also follow this morphology here. And what happens here is that your prompt decays can give you electrons and positrons. These will cool under inverse Compton and synchrotron radiation to give you a steady state population, which can then upscatter in interstellar radiation fields, the CMB, et cetera, and that will give you gamma rays again. And this roughly traces that these energies we're interested in the morphology of dark matter we expect in the Milky Way. And then finally, a very important contribution for dark matter decay is the extragalactic spectrum. So as I said earlier, there's dark matter all throughout the universe, so those decays will also give us photons. What's particularly interesting in the photon case as opposed to neutrinos, for neutrinos they essentially just redshift. For photons, they actually undergo cascade-type processes. So once you get to high enough energies, a photon can pair create an E plus E minus pair off the CMB. And then those electrons can then inverse Compton or synchrotron cool. And ultimately, what you need to do is solve a couple pair of Boltzmann equations. And it turns out that if you even if you inject a photon at, say, the gut scale, you end up getting a lot of energy at much a lot of power at much lower energies where Fermi can see it. So you need to take this into account as well. And this will, even though the spectrum will get distorted quite a bit, the spatial morphology will just look isotropic. And again, we need to combine both of those. So to give you more of a pictorial representation of what you expect, so at much lower masses, which is what people usually talk about using Fermi for to set limits on dark matter decay or annihilation, you have, say, 100 GeV, you have a prompt flux that looks like this, and you have an extragalactic flux. And you can see that usually people only consider the prompt flux, and that's a pretty good approximation because it's explaining most of what you see in the Fermi energy range. On the right-hand side here, I'm showing you a 10 PeV dark matter candidate, so one much more relevant for, say, Ice Cube. And here you can see that in the Fermi energy range, the prompt flux is not very great. And this is peaked, instead it's actually peaked up near the dark matter mass. What you actually get a lot of is the inverse Compton spectrum and the extragalactic spectrum. And so you can see this is basically this reason why I said earlier Fermi is able to set limits at a much higher mass than you would naively expect just from the prompt contribution, which is peaked around its mass. It's because especially this extragalactic component allows you to reprocess a lot of the photons that are injected down to much lower energies where Fermi can actually detect them. And so something else I just want to point out is that Fermi has now been running for a lot, quite a few number of years. I think it's order 10 years now. And so we're not going to get a huge increase in statistics from Fermi anytime soon. Hawk, however, is going to be one of the new players in town, and it's only just starting to come online. And Hawk is sensitive at much higher energies. And you can see in this 10 PeV case, you'll be able to absorb a lot of more of the prompt flux here with an experiment like Hawk. So Hawk is potentially the next best instrument after Fermi for improving these things. And currently we're in talks with the Hawk collaboration to use our method to set limits on dark matter decay. Okay, so that's what you expect to see in terms of the spectrum. Let me just give you one slide on how we do the statistics of taking the Fermi data and turning that into a limit. I'll have a pictorial version of this on the next slide, so you don't need to follow it in any great detail. But basically, what you get from Fermi at first order is just a list of photons with a galactic longitude, latitude, and an energy. We then bin these into energy bins and spatial bins, so then we just get an array of integers where index is the energy and P index is the pixel. We then want to describe this data with some set of model parameters, some that describe the dark matter because we're trying to look for it or set limits on it, and a bunch of nuisance parameters, which is basically the fact that we know lots of other things in the universe give us gamma rays. We will then want to describe this data using the Poisson likelihood, where this mu is built up from our model parameters. We can then eliminate our nuisance parameters using the profile likelihood method so that now we've reduced our likelihood to just a function of the dark matter parameters. And then something that makes our life very simple, what you really want is a likelihood for a given dark matter model, which could depend on parameters like the lifetime and the mass. But as I showed you earlier, any given model will just map onto a certain amount of galactic flux and a certain amount of extragalactic flux. And so rather than having to compute this likelihood for all the models you care about, you only have to compute it for various different values of the isotropic and the galactic flux, which you can then map back onto any given model. So this greatly speeds up the calculation of this. So in pictures, what we're doing here, we have the Fermi data. We want to describe it as a combination of dark matter flux and the various background models we expect to contribute to it. We fix an input amount of dark matter flux, essentially marginalize over these, and then we can get a likelihood for that amount of dark matter flux. We then vary the dark matter flux, increasing it, and at some point, unfortunately, we didn't discover dark matter, so instead you just begin to become disfavored. And so this is, for example, what you get in one energy bin. We can then repeat that in many energy bins. So just to give you a bit of an insight into some of the details you need to account for when you're doing this carefully, this is a gross oversimplification. More realistically, we do something like this here. You would want to look at all the sky at once, but this is unrealistic. And so what you end up trying to do is you're competing between two different things. One of these is for dark matter decay. As I said, this extragalactic component makes up a lot of the flux, so you want to look at a larger region of the sky as possible. But the reason you don't want to do this, and this is something that's been well understood in some work I've done on the galactic center axis, and it also plays a role in when you're trying to understand the Fermi bubbles, we've only just started to really understand the gamma ray sky, and our models of it are still pretty average. And the problem is, you might really care about the dark matter flux here, but you might have a particularly bad aspect of your background model over here. So if you try and use the whole sky at once, you can get dominated by where you have a bad fit. So let me just briefly say a few more words about each of these points. So firstly, this is what you would expect from dark matter annihilation flux. And you can see that it, and this is in a map where you've subtracted all the galactic foreground, and you can just see the dark matter. And so you can see that this peaks towards the galactic center, as you would expect, but it also peaks towards certain areas of substructure, such as dwarfs. And this is why people often use dwarfs to set very strong limits on dark matter annihilation. For dark matter decay, however, the distribution follows the dark matter density, not squared. And so you don't get this same substructure boost. So generally you want to look at, the galactic center is great, but it's very hard to model astrophysically. So generally you want to look at a large region that's maybe a bit off the galactic center, which is what we did. And just a quick word on the issue with background modeling. What I'm showing you here is the region around the galactic center where we've subtracted everything we know about, even the galactic center axis. And so if this we had a perfect model of the galaxy, this would just be Poisson noise. You can see absolutely this is not Poisson noise. For example, on the right, it's brighter than on the left, and that's because none of our background models account for the fact that the Milky Way is a spiral galaxy, and it has structures all over the place. So it's a very hard problem. People are working on it, but you're much more susceptible to this problem if you look at a larger region of the sky, so we don't do that. Okay, so we can then repeat the process I showed you earlier in many different energy bins, and we can repeat the same process in Monte Carlo. You can see in some energy bins, we set a stronger limit in data than you would expect from Monte Carlo reasonably, and this is related to this background mismodeling issue. In some isolated bins, we have a slight excess. They're not enough to add up to a discovery of dark matter, but they're something that can happen. And so now I've shown you the various spectral contributions you expect for dark matter. I've shown you for a given amount of injected flux, how you set a limit. Let's put those two things together to set a specific limit for our dark matter to BB bar dark matter decay model. And I'll do this in terms of the three different contributions I mentioned earlier, prompt, inverse Compton, and extragalactic. So firstly, this is the limit you could set if you just consider the prompt data. You see, at the high energies, high masses we really care about for dark matter, we have reasonable good agreement between data and Monte Carlo. At low masses, we're setting a stronger limit. This is being driven by this oversubtraction I talked about. And at intermediate masses, we set a slightly weaker limit due to those slight excesses I pointed you to. We can do the same thing in inverse Compton. Remember, the inverse Compton spectrum is peaked at much lower energies than the dark matter mass. And so essentially you end up with a similar story just shifted a bit to the right, where this disagreement here is coming from the same reasons as that disagreement there. And finally, we can add in the extragalactic contribution. What's interesting, you can see at these highest masses, the three different contributions are all giving a relatively equivalent contribution to the constraint, and so by considering all of them, you get the strongest limit. And this is shown when we put everything together. At low masses, the standard law that you only need to think about prompt emission is correct, but at high masses, you really want to think about all of these, and our work was the first one to put them all together. Okay, so then we've set our limit. We can just go and see how that does in terms of IceCube, and as I showed you earlier, it really cuts into the interesting parameter range. If you want to explain everything you've seen at IceCube is coming from dark matter. Okay. So let me say quickly just a couple of words about, I've already shown you that modeling the gamma ray sky is challenging. So I just gave you one line. Why should you trust that what I did was correct and we have our various systematics under control? So one way that we tried to ease our own concerns about this was to repeat our analysis by changing a number of the different analysis parameters that went into that and see what happened to the limit. So by default, we use an NFW profile. What if we used a Burkert profile? You get almost the same limit. What if you don't trust the high energy Fermi data? I don't know why, but you could just cut that out because I haven't seen many photons up here and the detector response therefore is maybe not as well understood. If you cut that out, understandably the limit at high masses gets weaker. And we also consider a number of other variations on this. One, I was going to say a few more words about, but I might skip over because I'm running out of time a little bit, was that we actually, when we did our analysis, we only considered the best data in terms of Fermi grades how good the data is in terms of event reconstruction. When we go and use all the data, which actually is four times as many photons, we get a worse limit, which is not how statistics is supposed to work. So initially, we were a bit worried about this, but basically, the answer to this problem is that when you go to the worst quality data, these issues regarding background modeling become much more substantial, and it ends up combining in a way that leads you to a worse limit. But I can talk about that more if people are interested, but I'll just skip over that for the second. So one further systematic check we did, if we really aren't seeing anything about dark matter, there should be nothing special about the fact we looked at the galactic center. Because even though the dark matter is peaked there, we didn't see anything we claimed, so we should be able to repeat our analysis looking anywhere on the sky at some level. And the thing that you're checking by doing this is that your mismodeling of certain aspects of the sky isn't what's dominating the analysis. And so what we did in this systematic check here is repeated our analysis at a number of different points on the sky, and this is the band of the limits that we get there, and we see that what we arrived at the galactic center is consistent with those. And in any of the cases, it's definitely cutting into the ice cube parameter space.
So when you look at those other parts of the sky, are you using completely different gamma ray map?
Of course. We don't. Otherwise, it would just be terrible. Okay. But we pretend that, for example, the dark matter peaks where we're looking.
So you still pretend there's an FW profile
wherever we're looking. Yeah, exactly. But we adjust all the modeling of the backgrounds. For example, when we look at the galactic center, we account for the Fermi bubbles. When we look at the galactic anti-center, we don't, because they're not there. Okay, so that's where the black line comes from and why we trust that what we're doing is roughly correct. And let me now tell you a few words about the physics that goes into these other lines here. So firstly, before us, there were a number of other people who had set limits using the Fermi data, using extragalactic only in blue here and in brown, and also galactic only, which is in cyan here. So why are our limits generally better or sometimes worse? Well, we used all the different contributions, as mentioned, and also we used more up-to-date data and background models. Lost out, for example, to these authors here. One of the things that they did was when measuring the extragalactic component, they assumed that we very well understand the blazar and, say, starburst galaxy, for example, contributions to those flux. And I'm not sure this was the most conservative way to do this. So they essentially say we know a large component of what's contributing to this extragalactic flux, and then they just set a limit on what else can fit in there. So when we did our analysis, we said we don't know, which is maybe too conservative, but it was more conservative, so we don't know anything about what's contributing to this extragalactic flux, so we just fully marginalized over it. So that's why we lost out there. AMSO2 can also set limits on dark matter decay. For BB bar, the anti-proton limits are the strongest. The positron limits much weaker. But if we looked at, say, E plus E minus, these would flip around. And the AMS limits are stronger than ours. Also down the bottom here, this is the limit you would get from the CMB. I'm not putting this on here to embarrass these authors at all. Their limits become very important when you go to much lower masses. So for BB bar, this isn't relevant because we're almost at threshold here. But if you go to, say, E plus E minus, Fermi can't see anything below a couple of hundred MeV. AMS runs into issues of solar modulation at low energies. The CMB becomes the best player in town when you go to much lower energies for certain final states. So it's one to keep in mind. And then one final contribution that we discovered when we were doing this this work that I hadn't known about before is this work by these Russian authors, where what they're doing here is they're using the fact that these very large Earth-based experiments looking for cosmic rays, such as the Piaget Observatory, Cascadia and Casimir, that have measured these extremely high-energy cosmic rays I mentioned earlier, have tried to find photons and so far have measured zero to some confidence interval. And so when you've seen zero photons, you can set a very strong limit on the presence of any. And so what they're doing here is they're saying if you had these dark matter models, they actually go all the way up to the gut scale. If you had a dark matter model up here that gave you any photon, these experiments can set an exceptionally good limit on it. And just to bring things back before, you might remember that I said earlier that at these very high energies, these photons will end up pair creating off the CMB. Well, actually, that's mainly true for extragalactic, and it's not as much of a problem for galactic photons. And the reason for this is when you pass this E plus E minus threshold, the probability that a photon will reach us goes down substantially. But as you go further up in energy, the cross-section decreases, and it becomes less likely that it will actually scatter. For an extragalactic photon, it just travels so long that eventually it will pair create. But for a galactic photon, it can actually free stream from, the, say, the galactic center straight to us. And so if we had dark matter at the gut scale and it was producing photons, these experiments should have seen it. So you can set very, very strong limits. I mean, I'm emphasizing my own work and not theirs, but theirs actually go up quite a bit. So you get very strong limits with these experiments at these high masses. Great, so this ends the main part of my talk. I'm gonna say a few words about other final states and models after this, but this now summarizes everything I wanted to put into this plot here. So we have where you would want to think about for Ice Cube, the limits that we set using Fermi that cut right into this. But there's also a lot of other interesting physics that goes into the lines on this paper, and it's the combination of many different experiments. And hopefully Hawk will be able to add their own word onto this plot soon as well. Okay, so let me say a few more words about different final states and how we can go even beyond this towards specific models. So I've only mentioned BB bar, and when I'm showing limits in my talk so far, we considered 31 different two-body final states in our paper, and they're all available for download online if you want to set limits on your own particular model that is some combination of these final states. So here's a subset of these. What I'm showing you in the lines here is the limit we set using Fermi, and what I'm showing you for the star is for this particular final state, what would be the best fit point in mass and lifetime for an explanation for some contribution to the ice cube flux. So for anything other than a hadronic final state, you're only going to be able to explain a small part of the ice cube flux, but you can still find the best fit point for that. And what you can see here, we have leptonic, neutrino, light quarks, and then bosons. And then for every case, except for the neutrinos, the best fit point is in tension with what we're seeing at Fermi. Even for the neutrinos, though, it's almost within an order of magnitude. And this is only possible because of these electroweak corrections. And so as these constraints get stronger, it might even be this case comes into tension. So there's some interesting physics in terms of what is causing various wiggles in these lines here. One thing that was interesting that we found in the course of this project that maybe people knew but I didn't know before is that you can't run Pythia below 10 GeV. And so that's why the light quarks all have the same mass threshold here. So sometimes when people set limits below this thing, they're just interpolating Pythia limits for higher masses lower. But the reason that Pythia doesn't run below here is it doesn't account for many of the hadronic resonance, such as the rho. And so they deliberately don't let you run down here. So people often just leave that out and pretend it doesn't exist. Those things don't exist.
So when you say electric corrections, you're just pointing out that every time you get hit in neutrinos, then you have a loop processor, you had a W and a gamma coming off of it for photons, or is this something else?
I mean, at some level, it's just that you can, I mean, obviously you have to change to a lepton if you're rating a W, but you can, just for example, you think of the Z case, you have a neutrino, you just have a Z rating off as a higher order correction, right? And so, and then that Z can, when it decays, can give you photons. So, and this is something that is incorporated in Pythia, so we didn't need to calculate that. I mean, it's recently been incorporated in Pythia, because as I showed, it's a real effect you can measure at the LHC. But it's not something that we had to theoretically calculate. You can just get that out of Pythia. So just one, you might have seen there was a recent press release from AMS saying that they may have seen a cutoff in their positron excess spectrum, and this is sort of the cutoff you might expect from dark matter. You could also explain a cutoff with lots of other models, but just to say in past that if you did want to think of this as coming from dark matter, actually the best fit parameter point for this would also be excluded by our decay limits that we set. No, this is for E plus E minus. Yeah. Okay. So let me say just a couple of words about going to more complete models. So the first naive thing, everything I've been talking about today is just a specific final state. You just have dark matter decay to some FFR, for example, where F was B throughout the majority of my talk. So maybe the simplest thing you might try and do to build up a more UV complete model of this would be to say, try a Z prime model. And then you can write down a Lagrangian term like this, immediately calculate a decay rate. And from this, what we want to do is we want to fit this to masses around a PeV, because that's where we've seen the neutrinos. We want a lifetime of around 10 to the 27 seconds, because that's what you need to have to explain the ice cube flux. So you need a G of about 10 to the minus 28. So maybe not the best start. And so when we were reading the literature, we didn't come across too many models that seemed Well, not really, none of the models we came across in our limited reading of the literature seemed that well motivated. They all seem to have a 10 to the minus 28 hiding somewhere. So one thing that we thought about was glue balls. I'll come back to that in a second. But actually, Mina pointed out to me yesterday that she'd done some work back in 2008 and 2009 with a number of authors where they thought about Suzy Gut models decaying through dimension six operators. And actually, these models, I only found out about this yesterday, so we need to look into it in more detail. But it appears that some of these models might be able to give you a more natural explanation of the ice cube data. But one thing we thought about was these glue ball models. And so basically the glue ball dark matter is where you have some secluded sector, which is just a confining SUN gauge theory with no matter content. And so then the lowest lying state here will be a glue ball, and it's naturally long lived, and so it's a potential dark matter candidate. And so you can actually determine what the mass should be for this glue ball once you know the n of the SUN. And it turns out, I mean, this is a bit hand-wavy, but for SU3, if you want this gauge group to unify with a standard model, you can determine where this thing should confine and therefore what the mass of the glue ball should be. It comes out to be about 100 TeV, which is roughly what you want for IceCube. Also, you know the lowest order coupling to the standard model will look something like this dimension six operator here. And so when you, where GG Joule is the dark field strength, when you pull the gluon out, the glue ball out of this, you can again calculate the lifetime, similar to how I did on the previous slide. And it turns out, if you have this SU3 that's at 100 TeV, and you have a Planck suppressed operator here, then you actually right on get roughly the lifetime that you want for IceCube. However, this scaling, this 4 and the 5 between the mass and the between the mass and the operator, is also achieved by this Suzy Gut model. So definitely glue balls aren't the only thing that can achieve this, but they're one potentially interesting way to explain the IceCube data a bit more naturally. However, they will also give you photons. And so you can set a limit on them using the data that we have from Fermi. And again, the best fit point to explain what you see at IceCube is in tension with what we see at the Fermi data. So as I said, we considered a huge number of different final states, and of those, we put all of them online so you can build up your own model. But I mean, 31 isn't every possible final state dark matter could give you. There could be other things. And so we also put our flux likelihood tables online. So if you have your own model, you can build up the constraint itself if it's something we didn't consider. Okay, so to sum up, IceCube is already seeing some very interesting results, but personally I don't think that everything they're seeing is coming from dark matter. But if somebody does and you want to start model building for that, you need to keep into account what the constraints that come from other experiments, and particularly what I've shown you today is the constraints that come from the Fermi experiment. But I just want to end with emphasizing one more time that if the dark matter of our universe really is at this very heavy scale, it could be IceCube that sees the first hints of it, because it's really probing an untouched scale up here. So it's very early days for that experiment, but I think that it'll be very interesting to see where that data goes in a couple of years as they better understand their systematics. Okay, thank you.
Questions?
So what sets the relative abundance of decaying dark matter?
I mean, that's very model dependent, right? Or do you mean the glue ball, or do you mean?
Oh yeah, for example, glue ball.
Yeah. So one thing we didn't at all give a complete treatment of the glue ball in our paper. My understanding is that glue ball models generically have, and I think one of these references here talks about this in more detail. Generically, have a lot of trouble explaining production issues, especially at these high masses. So if you really wanted this to be a very well-motivated model, you'd have to think about this more carefully. But the naive approaches to set the relic abundance don't seem to work.
And so this kind of ice cube and neutrino flux can be from annihilating dark matter also.
Potentially, although you'd have to do some model building. I'm not an expert on this, but naively, the unitarity bound, if you just took that out of the box.
Yeah, no, there's way to go get around it.
Yeah, but because of that, I mean, experimentalists often won't set limits on annihilation at these masses because they say the unitarity bound can't be beaten. But yeah, so it's possible, but you can't just reinterpret what we've done immediately in terms of annihilation because the shape of the flux would be very different. One, the prompt decay will look different because you're now looking at rho squared. Secondly, the extragalactic contribution is much more different because for decay, all you care about, dark matter particles don't need to find each other. You just care how much is out there. For annihilation, they have to find each other. And this now depends then on the cosmic evolution of galaxies, for example.
Right.
You need to understand that accurately to know, because as the galaxies become more clumped, you get more annihilation flux. So there's a huge amount of uncertainty in the extragalactic or much more uncertainty in the extragalactic annihilation flux. So the analysis will be very, very different. So,
so you're saying the constraint may be weaker, or just you just have to redo it?
It depends how you do it, yeah. And I mean, weaker in what? I mean, you're comparing lifetime to cross-section. It's not obvious what you mean by.
Right. I see.
Quick question, just really quick. When you did the Burkert test, do you remember what your core size was for your Burkert?
No, I do not. Okay. I have that enough. Yeah,
I don't
remember.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay. Any other questions? Okay. I thank the speaker.
Thanks.